Hello and welcome to episode 23 of Friday Flix's Pixar Rewatch. It's Friday.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started in here.
Ha! Oh, Fridays are so fun. There's just such a good time. Looking forward to a weekend.
Movie day.
It's also 2022, you guys.
Oh, yeah.
This is our first one in 2022? Is it? Okay.
Happy New Year.
Oh, wow.
Happy New Year. Appropriate, since today one of the main characters we'll be talking about is named 22.
Okay.
We are here to talk about Pixar's 23rd. And so for our penultimate movie, Soul, but they have some new ones coming out this year, which we'll also talk about as well. Since you're here, you might as well just hit that subscribe button. If you've been coming back every week, well, we don't release every week, but every time to hear our new episode, that's amazing. But, you know, instead of having to come back and check when we have a new episode drop, if you just click subscribe on your phone right now, it'll tell you when we have a new episode and you can hear it right away. And while you're doing that, write us a review. Let us know what you think. We've almost gone through all of Pixar's movies and we've barely heard from that many of you. We really want to know how you think we're doing. And you can also let us know by following us on Facebook and Instagram at Friday Flix Podcast. And please send us an email. Send us a super long one about your favorite things, your least favorite things. Who's the most annoying? Who's the most annoying one here? Probably me. I really want to know. Email us at jkentertainment247@gmail.com because we're here entertaining and watching movies 24/7.
We are friends and family watching and talking. Air horns. That was supposed to be.
Oh, we got it.
I got that.
Yeah, that was a good air horn. Great.
The air horn thing is tired, though. It's I'm okay. Sorry. I just, you know.
Old hat.
It was lazy. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see who's here with us today. We're almost back to our original gang, which is pretty fun. But with us, as always, is the wonderful Jimmy Anthony. And he's going to be our band teacher. Joe Gardner.
Music is all I think about. From the moment I wake up in the morning to the moment I fall asleep at night. I was born to play. It's my reason for living.
That was okay, right?
Yeah, not.
Okay. No notes.
It's okay.
Just, you know, I'm eggshells there. Hey, well. Yeah.
I think we'll let it go.
Okay.
Back with us is Byron Anthony, and he's gonna be Terry.
Oi, the cape's off, and I'm gonna come find him. You're coming back with me, see? We're gonna get this cape right.
Nice. Grace Anthony is also here, and she's gonna be 22.
Joe, I've been here for who knows how long, and I've never seen anything that's made me want to live. And then you come along, your life is so sad and pathetic, and you're working so hard to get it back. Why? I got to see this.
Cynthia Anthony is also here. She's going to be one of the counselor, Jerry.
You 5 will be insecure, and you 12 will be self-absorbed.
And Brian Baldwin is finally back with us. He will be another counselor, Jerry.
Oh, you mentors and your passions, your purposes, your meanings of life. So basic.
I like how after the quote Cynthia said, you 12 will be self-absorbed. The other Jerry goes, maybe we should stop putting so many people through that. I forget the word he uses, through that building.
Yeah,
or whatever.
I know. That is a good chuckle.
Daniel McCarley is also here, and he's going to be Moonwind.
Well, we have to perform an old-fashioned astral transmigration displacement.
Okay.
We have to wait for another thin spot between the Earth and the astral plane, and that won't occur until Orcus moves into the House of Gemini.
Nice, nice. Good one.
All right.
Yeah, well done.
I am your host, Kelly Anthony, and I will be Dorothea Williams. I heard the story about a fish. He swims up to this older fish and says, I'm trying to find this thing they call the ocean. The ocean, says the older fish, that's what you're in right now. This, says the young fish, this is water. What I want is the ocean. See you tomorrow, Teach. I like that quote.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, no, that's a great one.
All right.
It did leave me thinking for a while.
I know.
I know. We just watched and I it was my friend that I was sitting with. I was like, oh, that's so good.
And I like how, like, there's a significant, like, we all probably were like, huh. And there's, like, a significant pause after she says that. And he, I don't even think he says anything back. And she just goes, see you tomorrow.
Like, just standing there and staring and thinking. And, like, the scene behind him changes, like, almost like a time lapse. Like, he's been thinking about it for a long time.
Kind of thing. They never, ever fully address that. They just leave you with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, before we get into the movie, again, we're talking about Soul, which came out on Christmas Day 2020. And Daniel, why don't you go ahead and give us some maybe box office Oscar trivia? Shoot.
Yeah, I was trying to do some research and find out. So, so this was released on Disney Plus on December 25th, 2020 in the U.S. And I can't find evidence that it ever had any kind of theatrical release in the U.S. Though it did have international release. Mostly in Asia, where it made a total of $120 million.
Okay.
It must have had some kind of release because it qualified for the Oscars. And in order to qualify for the Oscars, you have to have some kind of at least promotion.
Well, not that year.
Oh, that's true.
They lifted it, I think. That's true. I don't know if that still exists now, but that year they lifted that rule. Yeah.
You're right. They totally changed the rules for that. Which is why that got nominated. So yeah, so there's no, we don't know. Like Disney doesn't release the official streaming number, so we don't actually know.
But still over 100 million just in Asia. That's like very successful still. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what their budget was for this, but.
Yeah, mostly China and Korea, who I think like we're not in as much of a pandemic place.
You guys, you know, I wonder if movie theaters sort of become obsolete and everything is streaming. How will they determine the box office numbers? You know? I mean, they can't really tell how many
people
watched it. I guess subscribers to Disney, maybe.
I think that the box office will still be the box office. Like, I think movies will still always be released in theaters, even if they're also on streaming. And the box office numbers will always be released, but they're like, to like we've been saying the last few episodes, they're never going to be as big as they were in the past, because even if people are paying premiums or paying to subscribe to a thing to see it, that's never going to be counted as that the movie made that.
But did you see today? Spider-Man, it like became the number 6 most like grossing movie of all time in the world.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's doing pretty good.
But, right, like, if it had been 2 years ago, it would have probably been number one, you know? Or at least, you know,
Maybe, yeah.
I see sort of point. The pent-up demand for, like, going out to the theaters and stuff sort of drive to success. Yeah. I don't know, though. There's been stuff. Like, Eternals came out before it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. People have been seeing stuff.
But Spider-Man... No Way Home has been like the most hyped movie for the last year, if not longer.
Plus,
and like, Jimmy, like, we can't, like, we went and saw it twice in the theaters already. So we definitely contributed to that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyways, Daniel, other facts. What about the Oscars?
Oh, yeah. So this was nominated for and won both best animated feature and best original score. Mm. So that's, yeah, that's the Oscars.
What was the, didn't it get nominated for a third thing?
Maybe I was, think so.
I thought I saw it earlier, got nominated for three Oscars, but
oh, maybe best wrong. Sound. It got, and it was nominated for sound and it did not.
Okay. Win. That makes sense.
They combined the sound categories. Yes. Do you remember the movies nominated for best picture last year? Cause I don't think anybody does.
No. And last year was the first year I didn't watch the Oscars and didn't care about them.
Yeah. It's a, that year doesn't count kind of thing, but.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I wonder what kind of a release this would have had, though, like without the pandemic, because the fact that they just immediately like it's going to be on Disney Plus. No question or controversy about that.
I think we would have heard more about it. I probably would have seen it sooner if it, you know, had like a big theatrical release and publicity.
No,
I definitely would have seen it in theaters if it was a different time.
Sort of the trick with, or like it's tricky about streaming, like it seems sort of like free. You're paying for the subscription for the service, but like if you can choose when and where you want to watch it, it doesn't feel like this big event always if you don't care passionately about the material. So like when this came out, I was just like, oh yeah, I'll watch that whenever. And I didn't until this podcast, just because it was just sort of around.
Yeah.
There's no sense of urgency for it. Like there's no reason to watch it now.
Right.
If it's
on right
streaming. Did you say, Daniel, like when it was originally supposed to be released? Like, was it always going to be a big Christmas time movie or was it?
I don't know.
I think it was supposed to be, if I remember just from my own memory, I didn't look this up. I think it was originally supposed to be released like that year in October.
November. It was originally scheduled to be released theatrically on November 20th.
So Thanksgiving weekend, it was going to be a Thanksgiving weekend thing, probably. Yeah, that makes sense.
That does make sense. It's a good Thanksgiving movie, I feel like, even though it doesn't really feature Thanksgiving at all. Although there is pecan
pie. It feels like the fall. It feels like the fall with the trees and stuff, though. Uh-huh, yeah,
sweaters.
That's a good point. Yeah. It's like you got Bikini Band going. That's like fall semester right there.
True. Mm-hmm. Especially the way they're sounding.
Yeah. Well, hopefully. All right. Well, before we get too much more into it, let me give our listeners a quick synopsis. And again, I'm going to say spoiler warning because this movie's just over a year old. So if you haven't seen this movie yet, go watch it on Disney Plus. Come back and listen the rest of this episode. Yeah, you know, definitely don't want to spoil some stuff.
If you'd rather us review the movie without saying any spoilers, write us an email. Maybe we'll do it. I don't think it's a good idea. In fact, I think that wouldn't work at all. But hey, let us know.
All right. So quick synopsis of the movie. Joe Gardner, a middle school music teacher, feels stuck in life and unfulfilled at his job. He dreams of a career in jazz music, to which his seamstress mother objects. By chance, his former student Curly informs him of an opening in the band of jazz legend Dorothea Williams. Joe impresses Dorothea with his piano playing and is offered the job on the spot. As Joe happily heads off to prepare for his first performance later that night, he falls down a manhole and dies. Joe finds himself as a soul heading to the great beyond. Unwilling to die before his big break, he tries to escape but ends up in the great before, where soul counselors, all named Jerry, prepare unborn souls for life on Earth. Joe poses as an instructor who is set to train the souls and is assigned 22, a cynical soul who has remained in the great before for millennium and sees no point in living on Earth. 22 reveals that she has a badge that fills up with traits. She needs to find her spark to complete it, and she says she will give it to Joe so that he can return home, leading these two on a journey to discover what life is really all about. All right, so our first discussion topic, as always, is our overall animation style. And, you know, that can lead into a discussion on what did you think of the character design? And specifically, I really want to know what you guys thought about the design of the great before and the great beyond. Because these Pixar animators had to come up with, you know, like they say a lot in the movie, a hypothetical. Like, what does before life and afterlife really look like? They didn't have anything to go off of but their own imaginations, you know? Yeah. So what did you guys think?
Specifically didn't want it to represent any particular ideology or cultural thing, that it would be sort of totally novel as far as what they created and not referencing anything that we're used to seeing. So I thought it was very cool and very well done. I'm curious what you guys think.
I really love the contrast of like the real world and then like the kind of afterlife, like in just in terms of like kind of the 2D theme that they kind of went with in like the other world, you know. And then, but then in the real life, like there were so many times where I was looking at it and I had like thought that it switched to a real shot for a second because it looked so real, but it all like nicely tied together. Like it wasn't weird when they like transitioned, you know, through each other, like, but it was still two really intensely contrasting, like, kind of ideas that they went with, like, artistically, right?
I just really loved I loved them both. When we first, like, leave the great before, and when he's trying to jump down to Earth and it doesn't succeed, I initially thought, like, oh, man, I want to go back there, because I liked the animation style. I loved the neon lights and the simplicity of the Jerrys and all that. And like, because he says something like, I'm just what your human brain can imagine. So I think you kind of like give a lot of license with that when it's just a computer that's made us like a tangible image for us. It doesn't have to be like a fully fleshed out figure. But mostly I just loved the way that they illustrated the great beyond. Just the way that it, you know, is like that big ball of light, but kind of dissipates into that sort of 2D style of black and white dots and everything. I don't really know why, but I just really loved that image. I think it was beautiful. And I think it was a really great sort of universal way to illustrate that without making any sort of stance on anything. I think they both were. I liked it.
I kind of didn't like all the different styles. There was a lot going on. I loved the city and the Earth animation, because like you, Brian, I agree. It's so very real. And so that was just so stunning and captivating. And then sometimes it'd be kind of a black and white, you know, and then we have all these weird lines squiggling, and in the like in the Great Hall, everything is sort of a hue of blue. Anyways, at first this wasn't even really conscious thinking, but I know that it just sort of bugged me. I don't know why. Maybe the movie is, you know, nothing is linear, right? The movie poses more questions than it answers. And so maybe that was intended, that we're not in a recognizable universe. We're going to jump between space and time and even like different planes of thought and souls and all that. But it wasn't really favorable, in my opinion, until I really got well into the movie and then just accepted it, which is also a theme of the movie.
Or they're just the themes of the movie in general.
I mean, I think that both Cynthia and Grace have like said pretty much how I feel about like the two extremes of the design, because on one hand, it's super smart and super intelligent. The Jerrys are all sort of rendered in like almost like a Picasso cubist sort of aesthetic.
Yep.
And, you know, cubism is deliberately making something extremely complex look simple. That's what they were trying to do. They were like literally walking around objects and painting them from a million different angles. And that's why it looks weird, but it was a way to simplify something that's super complex. So I like the sort of, I don't know, I just like that manifestation of that idea in the design. But I do have to say, I kind of agree with Cynthia that there's just something that's a little trying to stare at the whole time for me. And I think that's because the animation of the real world is just so phenomenal. I remember thinking at one point, like, mm-hmm. when we got back to the real world, I was sort of like, oh, thank God. Like, this looks way more what I was like expecting.
I think that is somewhat intentional as well, because that is very thematically, you know, part of the movie.
You're right. And like, they don't, they make it an obvious transition back. Like, they come back. There's one scene when he opens the door and he walks out, I think, with like clothes into the fall weather after coming out of like the astral plane or whatever. And it was just such gorgeous, high, high caliber animation. It was just breathtaking in a way.
I think the I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, I think the animation is really cool. I think all of it's really great. I think, yeah, the real world stuff is great. The theoretical design stuff is great. It's very like controlled, I think, and very like, but it's really good. And I like watching it.
I'll just say too, the one thing that also kind of bugs me is just like the actual shape of like the soul, like what he looks like as like this weird little blue beam. After a while, I was just like, I find it
underwhelming as a design choice as well.
What would you have made him?
Hey, that's a totally fair question. I wish I had a better answer.
Genuinely asked, like not bitchily, literally at all.
No, just, I didn't. I think it's a great no. Like,
he's a little. Like he's a little poof.
Yeah, totally. It is like a little kind of breath or
like,
something.
Because like, I kind of agree with you. Like it's kind of weird. Like that could have been done a little better, I think, right? But
I'm trying to remember, were the spirits the ones that we're talking about, were they shown in the trailer? Did we already know what they were going to look like?
I know.
I think so. I think they were a little bit.
Because I remember initially on the first viewing, well, and this is something I think we'll all end up saying at some point, that we all liked it more the second time, if you've seen it more than once. Especially when it came out, it was such a crazy time of year, and everything was all crazy that Christmas. But anyway, I remember the first time being underwhelmed by it, and this time as well, just like you guys were saying, that's all.
Did you guys even think that the animation for, it's not Moondance, what's his name? Moonwind, and his ship, and all that colorful, fantastical imagery. That was different than anything else we were seeing in the beyond or the after. Right? So, of course, that was really on a metaphysical
plane. They were in a different place.
In the zone.
Yeah. So there again, another design choice. You know, an intentional difference. And actually the way the characters were manifested.
Yeah.
And that.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what a lot of you guys are saying. I think the very first time I saw this, I felt like what Cynthia and Byron are kind of saying, how it felt really disjointed and how like it kind of makes you feel uncomfortable almost watching it because you're not really sure. Also because, you know, obviously I'm a music teacher. I love jazz. So, you know, when the movie starts and you're in the real world, you've got this great jazz music going, all the colors, and then it so quickly switches to this other place, which is really cool and effective, I guess. Like, I think they did a great job coming up with, you know, designing the great beyond and the great before. And I really love Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's music in general, whenever they score for films. And when we got to the great before, the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, now we're here. It's a little different. And I got into it. And then you go back to Earth and you're like, okay, now I'm shifting again my mindset of like where I'm at in this movie. But yeah, the second time watching it, knowing what it's going to be, I definitely like felt more relaxed watching because I was ready for all those changes. But I honestly really love the design of the great before. And like, I like the way they design the souls that are just like, let's just call them the baby souls that aren't people yet. But then like the dead souls, I guess, like Joe and, you know, Mother Teresa, how they kind of look like the way they looked in life, that doesn't seem right. But I kind of like the little just like circle, almost nothing kind of form of like the baby souls. Yeah. I like how they're very round and soft and inviting, and it kind of gives you that sense of their innocence and just, you know, they haven't lived yet and all that kind of stuff. I felt this the first time I watched this too. I really love the design of the Jerrys. I just think they're so cool the way they're two-dimensional and, like Byron said, like kind of Picasso-y, and the way like when they turn their like faces sort of flip to the side. And Jimmy and I watched this thing. It's actually on Disney Plus. They have a bunch of really short little videos about the making of the movie and how one of the Pixar animators, when they were coming up with the idea of the Jerrys, she animated them all with wires. And then she like put them against this like film and like turned off the lights and then shown like her phone flashlight camera. So they had like different shadows and like, see, that's how they animated their movement.
That's literally yeah, like a light modeling of what cubism is.
It's just really cool and so creative that they did that. And I always thought that the Jerrys looked cool. So I'm almost in awe of them and how they animated the Jerrys. It's really cool.
I changed my opinion from the first viewing to the second one. Again, I was sort of in a negative mindset on the first viewing, so I just didn't have a very positive opinion of this movie the first time I watched it. It improved the second time, but yeah, specifically the Jerrys, I appreciated a lot more this time, just for all the reasons you guys are saying. And like even at the bottom end of them, where the lines sort of meet the floor, it had this cool sort of flowing particle kind of look, which you see like throughout a lot of the visuals in that Great Before, or maybe in the Great Beyond as well, but like where everything's sort of, if you look close enough, it's made up of little tiny dots and pieces. And anyway, with the Jerrys, you can kind of see their lines like flowing out into these particles, which is like just a cool little detail I noticed this time that I didn't.
Were the Jerrys in the Great Beyond or the Great Before?
The Great Before.
Yeah. Although they can kind of go anywhere, including the real world, which is kind of like, but anyway.
Yeah. So that they're mostly in the Great Before, which they also call like the U seminar part of it. The Great Beyond is just the like black staircase and like the big ominous light bubble that they go into. Which honestly, I really like how simple they animate the Great Beyond, but also like how simple yet menacing it is. You know, you're like, oh, it's the end, but then this thing just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's like kind of scary.
It's both. It's inviting. Do you think
that it was? But did you think it was scary because he had to go there? You know, through the character's eyes, you thought it was scary, or just it's such a mystery? I didn't find it scary. I mean,
it's definitely intimidating.
What it represents, yeah. I think we all sort of subconsciously or consciously know what it represents. And the way it's scored, to be honest, also affects your emotional interpretation of it.
Like every time they show it.
Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
I loved it because I thought it was like across all religions and people and all kinds of things, people that have died and come back or something. Talk about a white light. And that's what I viewed that. And if you look at it, there's that white light on the screen, and then it dissipates into a million little lights, you know, which I kind of interpreted as like stars. It was like light that never ends. So it's funny, Kelly, it was kind of jarring right then when you used the word menacing. I did view it that way. But death itself and what is there is, you know, our deepest fears in so many ways, right? It's such a mystery. We just don't know.
But I think
I thought the visualization was actually lovely.
Yeah, no, but the thing about it that I think is so perfect and beautiful that Pixar pulled off is that I think it's both. I think it is inviting and like, oh, like if you're ready to die and like, oh, here I go, I'm going to float away and then zoop. Or whatever. But like it's also kind of menacing and scary. Like I'm dead. This is the end. Yeah. The little is funny.
I just said maybe it was an ode to A Bug's Life, the zap.
Oh yeah. No, I've definitely saw videos where people are making fun of the like, don't fly into the light, but it's so pretty.
Yeah. I mean, that's what that joke was making fun of in Bug's Life was.
Yeah. Related to the animation style, well, I guess it's also just the animation style. For our listeners who don't know, but I'm pretty sure most of you know, Jimmy and I are both music teachers. So this movie It's a very specific music teacher / educators. Specifically, I do band. I am a band teacher, high school, not middle school, though. But I gotta say, and when this movie came out, you know, it was all a buzz between us music teachers, what we thought of it. We'll get a little bit more into that later. But something that music teachers and musicians everywhere, when they saw this movie, were so thankful how well and truthfully they actually animated them playing the instruments. Because if you look at any media, any ads, anywhere, so much of the time you see like, oh, I don't know, it's an ad for whatever, health insurance, but it's like a family and there's a kid like playing the violin, but he's holding the violin on the wrong side, the complete wrong way. You know, people, I've seen pictures and ads of kids holding trumpets like the opposite way. And it's really frustrating. The way they animate, and I'm, for those of you that don't know, a trombone player, and we have a very prominent, the main student character, if you will, is a trombone player, is also female. Heck yeah. She is holding it very well. She's moving the slide the right way. Her face looks correct. It's just like, it's really pleasing for me to watch, honestly, like how correctly they're playing everything. The way they animated Dorothea Williams' character playing the saxophone is like, again, like almost beautiful for me to watch. And the way they animated him playing the piano on his fingers, it's like, again, like mesmerizing to me, like how well, and I mean, it doesn't, I don't want to say it looks real because they look like animated characters. They did. And, you know,
especially John Batiste, who wrote all of the jazz songs that are featured in the musical. He didn't write the, you know, original motion picture score. That was Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. But John Batiste wrote all of the jazz pieces that you hear that accompany the movie, that the musicians are playing sort of, you know, in the club or whatever. And all of the improvisations that Joe does was all John Batiste as well. And they filmed his fingers from a bunch of different angles and modeled Joe's, like, actual, like, the physicality of his fingers after John Batiste as well. So yeah, I assume they did that with all the instruments. I just don't know who they did for all those various instruments, who the artists were, but yeah, you can just tell it's modeled after real playing.
Cool. You know what I loved about that, especially the kind of, you know, close-ups of his hands on the piano, is you could like literally see and feel the tension in the fingers, you know, when his thumb and his little finger have to reach across those keys. And I don't know, it's hard to explain it, but it was so real that I could feel the power and the breath that it took to play the trombone and the saxophone, you know, even that guy Curly, the drummer, just the way his shoulders moved. It was excellent. That's worth watching, if nothing else. Those scenes.
I mean, it's again, bias, just like Kelly. But the musical sequences are by far my favorite parts of this movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's watching
them play music.
I mean, we'll talk a little bit later about what we think about the totality of the movie. But those moments of him being in the zone, especially that first one, I mean, of everything that Pixar has done, that is just like master level musicianship, animation, character, story, whatever element you want to pick. It is just so moving and beautiful. I completely agree with you. Just so special, those performances.
So we've seen, you kind of notice, but anybody who's like heard a fair amount, or even a small amount, I would think, of jazz piano can maybe recognize that what he's playing doesn't necessarily sound like traditional jazz piano. It's kind of noodly, and he's playing this like up and down sort of glissando kind of style. And it was John Batiste's way of sort of giving Joe, first of all, his own sort of ethereal sounding style as a musician, because musicians do tend to sort of have their own flavor style. So he wanted to represent, you know, something that was recognizable and distinct. But also, he specifically said in this little thing I was watching that he wanted it to be sort of recognizable to people who aren't really trained musicians. So that, like you were saying, Mom, that you could feel and imagine almost yourself playing that on a piano, and that it wasn't so esoteric or trapped in like the idioms or the specific phrasings and notes that jazz specifically tends to use, but that's more like universally recognizable in the style that he's playing. So I just thought that was really interesting. Wanted to throw that in. Mm-hmm.
Great segue, Jimmy. I was just going to also, like, as we were talking about the animation, the musicians, just what were people's overall thoughts of the music? I know we've talked a little bit about that already, but what did you guys think of the score of the Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross side, the John Batiste jazz side? What did you guys think?
It was great. Yeah, like the jazz is great. The Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross score is great. Like the sound design.
Yeah.
And that's like, yeah, I mean, the whole sound design in the movie and the use of music is, I mean, Jimmy already said it, but that stuff is great.
I love, honestly, like just the way that they use kind of music as like a vehicle just to kind of like illustrate, especially the fact that he's like an improvisational jazz, you know,
right.
And kind of just like illustrates the way that life just keeps happening, and like you just have to like kind of keep going and go with the flow, and like it just like, I don't know, I love how they kind of try to make that statement through music. I think it's so creative that way.
I thought the music was wonderful. I have no complaints whatsoever about the music. I mean, it's hard in my mind, even though we've done all these podcasts on all the Pixar films up to this point, to even remember anything as good. The first Toy Story was marvelous because that was so unique, but this music was just outstanding, and you know, varied. It wasn't all one, no pun intended, one note. and it was such an homage to jazz. It glorified it and made it, you know, really beautiful. And I think understandable to people that might not be familiar with it. One of the things I loved about it, and it's true about jazz, but I never thought about it much, is just the way the various players would sort of give space for the others to improvise. Mm-hmm. There's just this communication. Dorothea is looking at him, you know, and she just kind of is in awe herself. And just lets him riff, lets him go for it. And so that unique thing that happens in jazz is not, you know, heavily rehearsed and exactly the same every time, I thought was very well portrayed. Music was great in this movie.
Yeah, I really liked it too. I thought that, like you were saying, that the type of like improvisational jazz piano is much different than what I've heard. But it was great. And it also sort of does a good job of when you hear, you know, I really love jazz. There's a lot of us that would be like, ugh, you know, but it, so it recognizes that and then kind of answers that question and shows you how it can be really beautiful and really magical. And it doesn't have to be like old, gross, stiff, you know, just like bananas music that sounds like nothing. So I think that it really shows it to us like as if somebody who loved it dearly would show it to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I felt like, one area I thought they could have explored more was the actual instruments themselves. I was like, you know, they had just, you're talking about music with musicians, and Pixar seems to objectify most. They're like, you know, there's all this like cars coming to life and toys coming to life. I just feel like, I don't know, I felt like instruments themselves could have been a larger presence.
Great segue into my next topic, which is, and I'm going to start with Jimmy. Like I said, we're the two actual music teachers here.
Okay.
What did you think? I don't know if you had any preconceived notions, Jimmy, going to this movie. I know I did, which was bad for my first viewing, but what did you actually think about the portrayal of him as a music teacher, or what were your thoughts on like that side of the film?
Well, yeah, I just assumed it would be more about him being a music teacher. Again, that was probably just me like wishful thinking on my part. I didn't even know I was wishing for that. But, you know, knowing through the ads and stuff that he was going to be a music teacher, I was like, oh, cool. Like a music teacher main character. And then to find out like, oh no, he's only kind of doing this as a temporary side gig. And he actually would really rather not do it. And he has this other dream of being a performer. And like, you know, it turns out by the end that he learns that part of his purpose is to be a mentor and to share the beauty of life with other people. But, you know, you don't get there until later in the movie. So for a long portion of the movie, the first time I was kind of disappointed and just the fact that they weren't featuring a teacher love to teach. But, you know, that's okay because they were telling a different story. And so, again, on the second viewing, I was much more open-minded about it. And I think it still tells a valuable message. As far as, like, the way they represent him as a teacher, if I was to, be, like, evaluate him as a teacher, you know, his heart's not in it necessarily. It's sort of obvious. I mean, we only see him actually teach like once, maybe, right? Or maybe twice. But anyway, you know, but when he describes to them everything and he's sitting there at the piano and telling that wonderful story, like that is inspiring. And that would be something a good teacher would want to do. So I don't have any major qualms with him as a teacher, but just what I said, just sort of disappointed that I thought it was going to be about a teacher who loved to teach, and it wasn't.
Yeah, same. And I, from what I saw online, a lot of music teachers were upset that the ads, like you said, were like, it's a music teacher, but then he dies. And then that's kind of all I feel like I got from the trailers. But I was like, okay, but it's still about a music teacher. That must be like a big part of the movie. And it starts out that way. And by the way, I love how they do like totally horrible beginning band, like Disney theme when they show the castle at the beginning. So funny.
Yeah, that's so funny.
Yeah. And how well it transitions into like him teaching and the way he's just like, and go. Oh, that was C sharp. Oh, he forgot his instrument. It's okay. Let's go on. Like, that's just my life every day.
All right. I hope your beginning band students don't listen to this, Kelly, but that's okay.
They definitely don't. And if they did, they would agree with me though. It's fine. But also in the hallway, when he comes out to talk to the principal, and he's like, I forget the exact line, but he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, oh, don't worry. She's like, can I have a minute? He's like, don't worry. You're saving my ears in there. And then a kid walks out and he's like, hey, and he's like, but not you. You're great. He's not. That's so funny. Yeah. That's honestly one of like the only like parts I really chuckled at probably in the movie. Anyways.
Some good okay.
Well, there are a few other.
There are a few, but like that was like the first time I watched it, I don't think I actually laughed that much. Like that was like one of the only times. But anyways, yeah, I definitely was disappointed how little they are on the even show him being a teacher. Again, that's not really the point of the movie. So like knowing that at the end and then seeing it the second time, I was prepared for that. But, you know, then he's offered this full-time position and he doesn't look happy about it. And he doesn't seem to really care about his students. And I think for me, and from what I know from other music teachers seeing this movie, is that we were just a little disappointed that they portrayed him that way. And I think for us, we just are like, we hope that regular people who don't know music teachers that well watching this don't think we all feel that way as a music teacher, because it's definitely the opposite. Well, and, you know, listen,
I can understand music teachers being upset because really at the beginning of the movie, the antagonist is the mother, right? Mm-hmm. She wants him to take the full-time job. And so the job itself, he doesn't want to do it full-time because he wants to do his gigs. So in a way, the music teacher thing is the enemy, right? He wants not to have to do that. He wants to be an independent artist. And so if I was a music teacher, and I've been a drama teacher, so I can really imagine this, you know, it makes it look like people only teach because they can't get their gigs. People teach because it's just a filler job.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a bad...
Those who can't do that whole thing.
You know, yeah, I didn't like that either.
Yeah. But, you know, I listened to this other podcast by some other music teachers in Texas, one of whom who grew up in New York City. Her dad was a teacher and a musician. And she says, you know, she teaches in Texas. Texas is like crazy band world over there, like way more than California where we teach. And she's like, you know, I know a lot why people feel this way. Obviously, I'm a music teacher, but in New York City, it's way more common for music teachers to also be gigging musicians like him part time. And for them to just be using that as a way to make money until they make it big. And I was like refreshed to hear that, like, okay, thank you. Like, I didn't know that side of it because I'm not a music teacher in New York City. That totally makes sense. But that still doesn't, you know, again, I'm a music teacher and I had to hear it from her perspective as a music teacher to feel okay with that representation. So I don't know. Anyways, go ahead, Byron. You live in New York City, so.
No, I was just going to say, like, you know, there's like, I totally, like, I feel like it's almost like a waste of a character to have a music teacher if he's not going to like even have a moment where he truly realizes that he loves it, or I don't know. It just doesn't.
There's the moment on the stairs. I didn't mean to interrupt, but that is just lackluster because she doesn't even really say anything to the girl. Sorry, go ahead, but I'm totally interrupting.
No. I mean, I completely agree with you, but I think you know the other reality is that there are a lot of people trying to do what they want to do. And it's not, you know, you can't fault anyone who really wants to get somewhere, to get where they want to go and to do that. So I just want to say that, like, and not only that, but it is a reality that a lot of people have to supplement whatever they do with something. So, and that's, it can be any industry where you have people that are doing it with all their heart and other people that are there for a paycheck. And that's not exclusive to the performing arts or.
Right.
Or.
Mm-hmm. To Jimmy's point though, about the scene on the stairs. I mean, sure. That could be like that's like one of the only other times we see him being a teacher, but it's not even him. It's 22 just spouting out whatever she thinks.
Yeah.
And you know, right. The student's just like upset, but clearly doesn't really want to quit. She just didn't know what else to do and showed up. And like her teacher's just to her perspective going like, yeah, do whatever, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, wait, let me do, you know? And so it's like, and then that also made me upset that like, oh, 22 just spouting out whatever made this girl not want to quit. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. Go ahead, Byron.
Yeah. No, I was just because you have to wonder like how much Jamie Foxx was like, no, he's not a music teacher. Or like, you know, like, actually, we're going to be more ghosty, or I want to be a cat. Like, you know, I wonder how involved he was.
I mean, the music teacher business was like just a device to get to the greater themes of the story.
Right.
But yeah. It just so happens that the music was so spectacular.
Right. Very true.
Okay, well, you mentioned the cat. So let's go into that next topic of discussion. The first time I saw this movie, and I feel like this is the beginning of act two, if you will, when they wake up and he's in the fucking cat body.
Which is unfortunate that this black man spent the whole movie as a cat. I'll just say.
I mean, like, and like at least a good third of the movie as this cat. And even when we watched this the first time, Jimmy, in Paso, I remember looking at you and I just feel like I looked at you, maybe I said, or I think it was like a few scenes in with him as a cat. And I was just like, this is weird. Like, I just like was not
when
ready for
that,
him
I
to
was
be
like,
a cat.
Oh no, we've been Brave.
Like, I know. I like, oh my God. I think that's exactly what we said. It was exactly like Brave. It is the exact emotion I felt when the mom turned into a bear when I watched Brave. And I'm like, oh, he's just a fucking cat now. What happened to this jazz music teacher thing? And then that just like put me in a very negative mode. A very negative mood for the rest of the movie the first time I saw it. Unfortunately, again, the second time, knowing that was going to happen, I was like focusing on other things. But what did you guys think about the cat part of the movie?
I think it's not the strongest segment of the movie in a lot of ways. But like, you know, in the larger context for how the plot and the story works, I guess. But I think it
I
like
thought it was
goes
really
on a little too long.
I thought it was really silly, like all the stuff with him like falling asleep for a second in the sunshine, and it just, it doesn't really fit everything else. It's a little disjointed, but it's some, there's some funny points, and it's obviously like a vehicle for, you know, for the story to move forward, but it, I agree that it goes on too long.
You know, that one really powerful scene where he's talking to his mom and they like, you know, make up through the cat. That was annoying because at first the cat's like telling him what to say, but then the camera kind of crosses the line, as they say, that between the two actors talking to one another, which like is like a faux pas in like cinematography or direction, unless you're doing it to represent something, like a shift. Yeah, uh-huh. They do it in intentional ways. And so anyway, it was supposed to kind of like be like, okay, we're going to cut to the chase. Just imagine that the cat is telling him everything, and now we're just going to show him talking to his mom. But like that little conceit where it's just like, wait, what? Because he's like expressive and talking about his emotions and his life, but it's not really him. It's 22. That it was just like too far for me. I saw what they were going for, because it would have been so annoying to watch the cat say it and then him say it like back and forth. Exactly. So I get why they did it, but
also like all those people have just been watching this cat make those crazy sounds for the whole monologue.
Right. Yeah. That was already established earlier, that the cat is meowing and making all this noise while 22 is talking. Weird. I agree. Why do you suppose that they chose the cat? I guess because a cat maybe makes sense in a hospital. You know, I mean, this is an interesting choice. That's all that Pixar made the writers, you know?
Yeah, I think I cracked it up to Pixar just being Pixar and being ridiculous. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just like they caught me on a good day, but it didn't really bother me as much as it seemed to bother you all. I don't know. I kind of agree with Grace. At one point I was like, that cat would be, there's no way people would be like standing for a cat making all those noises. And they eventually says something about it. But like, yeah, does it make sense? No, but it's Pixar and they do that. So it didn't really, it didn't get in my way too much.
Yeah. That scene where he talks to his mom and she finally goes, oh, like, I never really realized you felt this way. I really want to support you. She goes to a show later. That's such a pivotal point for his character. And we're supposed to believe that 22 is saying all this for him. And again, I was also like, so they just kind of were like, just, you know, the cat is telling him what to say. And we're just going to cut that part out for time's sake and what efficiency's sake again, which I get. But I just, the whole time, again, the first time I was watching it, I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that the cat was probably making all these noises and telling him what to say. The second time I was just like, oh yeah, this is that part. Let me actually listen to what he's telling his mom. The first time I think I totally wasn't even focused on what he was telling his mom because I was just so caught up in like, this cat is there. I don't know. I mean, maybe you could argue that because, totally. You know, 22 kind of knows some extra things because she's in his body. They kind of allude to that a few times. So like, maybe you could argue that at some point he doesn't, as the cat, have to say anything anymore. 22 just knows what to say for him. Like, I'll just throw that out there for my own sanity. But again, I just felt like that's such a pivotal point for him as a character and his relationship with his mom. But it's all happening through 22. And I don't know how I feel about it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the complex. That's the problem. I mean, like, it's not bad. And it's like fun silliness, I guess. But it's just like, it's inconvenient. It's like kind of drags the story that like he has to work through all this stuff as a cat. And then there's like chase scenes and like they have to, and 22 has to like learn to use the body and stuff. And like that kind of stuff kind of drags the story instead of getting back to like,
I mean, they have to have some obstacles along the way.
I guess.
Exactly. That's like, it's the middle. It's like the end of the beginning when everything goes absolutely wrong. It becomes a cat. And now he has to deal with that. You know, like it's structured too, you know, as silly as it is, it gives momentum and
so they need talking animals are really big with the kiddos.
That's a good
something game. I didn't notice the first time though. This time I noticed though watching it. Like the first time I was like, oh, they just like missed which body to jump into. But 22 makes a comment when they first wake up. It's just kind of hectic. And like the first time you're watching, you're like, oh my God, he's a cat now. What? She does say like, oh, I guess it's because like you technically died and I've never lived. So I have to jump into like a new body or like a dead body. So then you took the cat. And then, okay. But then I also noticed how they're like, well, what happened to the cat? And then they show this quick little moment of like the cat's soul on like the staircase going to the great beyond. But then that's later, so yes. But then later they like later run the into the like fine. Owner of the cat. And then like the cat is just like, back in its body with the owner. Was the cat just running away from the light like the whole time and we didn't see?
No, she got helped by the Jerry's
counter guy.
Yeah,
Jerry must have dealt with that. Like you can't.
Okay,
have
I guess
souls.
Okay, I guess you're right. So but I just so was like
that little neon cat. It was like oh, God, that was
so there should be a spin-off Disney Plus series of like the cat's life.
What's just a short, name, Mr. We don't need a whole. We don't need a whole.
I don't give. I want a series. At least a web series or a series of shorts.
6 episodes minimum.
Moving along, but also kind of related to what we've been talking about. What did you guys actually think of Joe as a character? And then tied to that, what did you actually think of 22 as a character? Did you like them? Did you not like them?
Joe, like him. 22. No, I don't like 22. I wanted 22 out of this movie, and I'm sorry if you guys really love her. I'm very curious to hear your opinions, but it's one of the biggest tanks of this movie to me. It's just how annoying I find them, her, whatever. And Tina Fey, I'm just disappointed in her too. Or maybe it's the writing or something. Like Tina Fey is so awesome. Love that woman comedically, but man. Didn't work for me. It was a drag on the movie. I just wanted that character gone. By the end, you know, she grows and there's an arc, but I just, sorry, I'll stop now. But
she's not a character that like has a satisfying arc and like there's no redemption there for me still at the end of the movie for that character. It's like she just gets like super fucking lucky after like kind of just
that's a good point.
Yesing around for a minute, you know, and like obviously like she eventually gets there, but like would she if it wasn't a Disney movie? Maybe not, right? Like
yeah, I mean her whole character, the conception of her character, this soul who could never find its spark, and Plato, it's like this, and all these people couldn't mentor it to figure out to get ready for life. I'm still not solid on what that's the story of her character really is.
Not a very well-rounded character, which
not well explained.
I mean, it makes sense because she's like that's kind of what her character is like not a fully formed like personality. But I'm not gonna like not gonna get that one. Still could have been better.
Yeah, I don't know why she was so stubborn. You know, she was just kind of just a punk.
It doesn't all like, those make
mentors,
a lot of
you guys
sense.
I saw the list of all the mentors, right? The hello, my name is stickers behind her when she takes the guy into her house. It's like her little place where she lives, which is a box. And you know that's where Mother Teresa, Abraham Lincoln, Albert Einstein, a bunch of the Pixar animators, you know, I don't even know all of Aretha Franklin, this person, that person, this person. And so, you know, why? What was her problem? She couldn't get assigned a personality, I guess, because it was so bad.
In the end, isn't it like all you needed to do was be ready for life or something? Wait,
No. You guys, no. The whole end is because she can't do it because she's only ever heard that she can't do it. And that she's not good at this, she's not good at that. She'll never find her passion. And because that's the only thing she's ever heard, she's just retelling it to herself over and over and over. And that's what, like, that's how she detaches from life. She makes herself other than
she's
by
a lost soul.
Replaying that narrative that she's shitty and she'll never do it. So she never does it.
Thank you, Grace. That's really true.
That's the whole commentary on the mentor and mentee relationship. Is that we so often have people that whose judgment it sticks with us you know? And I think, I don't know. I think I'm a 35-year-old student at the moment. So it's been very interesting going back to education and you know, those types of relationships and considering what it means to have good teachers, because they're so rare. And I think we have two of them with us tonight, but you know, it's, I thought that moment when we kind of realized why she's become this lost soul, and you realize that she's just for her whole life heard that she's never going to have a purpose and she just can't do it. And then to be free of that, I think, I don't know. I thought it was, I guess I'm not even done completely unpacking it. Maybe I'm connecting dots that don't need to be, but I thought she did have somewhat of an arc, and I loved watching her enjoy life. Like when she lies down on the subway grate and she's, you know, in the fall and of course the little leaf.
That's true.
Like I enjoyed a lot of that.
I think
she's good at jazzing.
I did like watching that. Sorry, go ahead.
She's also, it's also a commentary on the little things that you say to children or people that are new at something, and how like he just was telling her, oh, that's just regular old life. Right. And how that little thing will stick in her head as discouragement forever and ever. And then it becomes even bigger when you see the retelling of it. And when she's a lost soul, he's saying more than he ever actually said, because she's created it into a bigger thing. So it's saying
she's repeating it to herself over and over. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question, Grace? Like when the first time when he says that line, did you like naturally think about like, oh, that's kind of a weird thing to say? Because I like the first time
making
he
it
said that
broader. Yes.
And then when they, yeah. And then addressing it so decisively, I thought that's an example of why, of what the power of words in education.
Yeah. Because you can kind of see that, like when he says it to her, you can see the disappointment. It's in Joe's face, but it's 22 as Joe, you know, because he's so excited about it. And he's like, that's just regular life. And you can see like a little drop in the, you know, the excitement.
Yeah, but when he says that, I think that's the moment she gets her spark to live, because when he says that, that's just regular old living. I think that's the moment she goes, oh, then I like living. I want to be here. If this is just life, when I get to talk to a barber and eat lollipops and listen to a jazz musician in the subway, like I want to be here. Yeah, because it's right after that when he's like, okay, because Moomin shows up and he's like, okay, are you ready to give me back my body? And she goes, no. And that's when she runs away. Yeah. Well, okay. So that's why I asked, because, okay, it's interesting you bring that moment up too, because that's the moment also the first time I saw this, when I didn't like Joe, when he says that to her. And I definitely didn't like Joe as a teacher when he goes, that's just regular old living. And the way he says it, and the way he's just like, whatever, get out of my body. I want to, it's all about me. It's all about me. I want to play my jazz show. It's not about you. And like, that's the moment the first time I watched it, when I was like, oh, really? I don't know.
Well, but a lot of Pixar characters, Woody and others have that moment where they go too far. They say the thing like, oh, no, don't say that. You know, like,
because they have to go through their journey.
Find out that like what they thought was their purpose wasn't necessarily like what they grew up thinking was going to be like their life's goal and fulfillment and purpose.
Yeah, like going so hard after that thing becomes like his way to detach from life.
Right.
You know? So you have to see him go too far.
I think it's really interesting, like, you know, when we first meet Moonwind and we see the lost souls, and how Moonwind goes, these are, I forget the exact word, but when a person's passion becomes an obsession that they can't get out of, that's when they become a lost soul. And I feel like it's, Joe is like basically on that borderline of becoming a lost soul. You know, he was so obsessed with becoming a famous jazz musician that he was not paying attention to his mom's, his relationship with his mom, whoever this random Lisa character is. They kind of just throw that out there. We don't find out who Lisa is. and him just not paying attention really to his students, I think. Mm-hmm. I was listening, watching some YouTube videos in this main YouTube channel about Pixar movies. I hope I can remember the quote correctly, but he said, "It's not about doing the thing you're passionate about. It's about feeling the passion when you do it." Something like that. And that Joe kind of lost sight of that. But I just thought it was an interesting summary of kind of what Pixar is trying to tell us. I also found some other interesting quotes straight from Pete Docter, the director and like writer of this movie, who also did Inside Out. And, you know, the first time you watch this and when you watch this, it's very Inside Out-y, especially the way the little souls look and just the existential themes of the movie. But here are a couple of quotes, and tell me you guys think of this, that Pete Docter said, "It's not about winners and losers. Everyone's life has value." And then the other quote was, "The movie's aim is really to say that we're already enough. We all can walk out of the door and enjoy life without needing to accomplish or prove anything. And that's really freeing." So Jimmy said something earlier too, where he said, you know, he thinks his purpose in life is to be a jazz musician, but it's really about being a mentor. And I feel like as music teachers, that's what we try to say about this movie, to feel better about ourselves. But in like really thinking about the theme of this movie and like what I've read about online, it's not. And even what Jerry says, like, "You people and your purposes, we don't give out purposes. Like, we don't do that. You just find a spark and then you go to Earth." Like, it's not about finding your purpose. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's not even about that. It's about Joe learning to just enjoy living, regardless of the fact that he's a music teacher or a musician. And again,
it's about creating your own meaning. Yeah.
I do really love that. That's the true message of this film, is enjoy your life and just live it to its fullest, no matter what you're doing. That's great. I felt like I went on this weird whirlwind and like, he's a music teacher. What's his purpose? Because the whole movie you're like, what is his purpose? And then the Jerry goes, "We don't do that." And you're like, wait, because the whole time I felt like, I mean, maybe you guys noticed it on your own, but as a viewer, the whole movie, I'm like, oh yeah, his purpose was to be a musician or maybe a teacher. What's her purpose going to be? Cause that's just the way they tell you, that they just tell you that's what it is. And then Jerry goes, no, it's not about that. And so then it's like, oh, I guess the movie's not about purpose. It's just about living your life. So again, there's where I felt disjointed and like, wait, what? I don't know.
Yeah.
Kelly, this is where I like kind of disagree with you, because I thought that was exactly the strength of the movie. Because and this goes back to what you were saying about the depiction of teachers. It looks like for a lot of this movie, it's heading in a direction where it's like, oh, like being a teacher was actually more what he was meant to do than being a, that's like predictably where it looks like it's going, but it doesn't. It goes in a much less predictable direction, in a much more like ambiguous and philosophical direction. And that's what I liked about it. It's about like the point of life isn't about just success and like having a job and being great at something. The point of living is to like experience life.
Yeah, eat pie, watch the leaves fall from the trees.
Instead of success and greatness, like, and all that stuff.
I think it's also kind of talking about how, you know, thinking that you have to have some big, great purpose is a little bit self-centered. Like to think that we all have to do something in the world to make some sort of impact, when really it's just maybe about just being here or being together. You
know, while we're talking about this, I love this conversation. I heard this quote in one of these things I was watching about with the director. What's his name again? Sorry, the writer director.
Pete Docter. He also did.
Yeah, there was
let me say this real quick. He also did, like we said, Inside Out. He did Up.
Yeah.
He did Monsters Inc. Some of the best Pixar movies. Go ahead.
Really good ones. Good track record. Well, anyway, he was talking about this movie and. This is like a 45 second clip, but he just mentioned some of the philosophies that are represented in the movie. It is, again, it's very short, but I could say it, but I thought he could say it better.
Thematically, of course, we knew from an early standpoint that we're going to talk about, using a fancy word, essentialism, the idea that, hey, we're each put on Earth with an essence of who we are and some sort of purpose. And Joe believes that. And then we got to argue the opposite with 22, who's kind of a nihilist, who's like, there's no point to anything. It's all absurd. And in the course of the film, he becomes, an existentialist, which is, yes, there's meaning, but you have to bring it yourself. You have to come out into the world with some point of view. And so it was a fun chance to talk about a lot of stuff that, we learned about in high school philosophy class, but hopefully done in a fun way through character.
So, yeah, from the director himself on that topic.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because I was trying to find a way to say that, because that's sort of how I felt about what was going on in the film, and sort of as Daniel just suggested, that it's ambiguous and existential and very much the sort of classic age-old philosophical questions. And I actually do think they succeeded in doing what he hoped that they did, which is they characterized philosophical questions, essentially. Mm-hmm. They made it a little zany. And they made a hell of a score to go with it. I think if we're going to, here we are pulling apart threads of this movie, but we can get existential about what is it to watch a movie? I think on a lot of layers, this movie succeeds more than it fails.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys think in that there's an underlying message about suicide? Because I definitely felt that this time. Really?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
I didn't think about that.
I know what you're asking me.
At one point in one of the videos I was watching, they're trying to boil down themes or characters, and essentially Joe is a character who doesn't want to die, and 22 is a character who doesn't want to live. But she's pre-born, so it's a little different than someone who's alive and doesn't want to live, but still, she doesn't want to live. So from that perspective, yeah, I mean, there are what's the point of living at all? Yeah.
The first time I saw this, I didn't think about suicide at all. But this time, the second time, before I even watched videos or looked up stuff about it, and nothing I watched even talked about suicide. But the second time I watched this, I really was wondering, and I meant to look it up and I didn't. Just I wonder if any suicide prevention organizations have any thoughts about that in this movie, or if just someone who is maybe thinking about suicide watched this movie, would they get that theme of, oh, maybe I should just enjoy eating a bagel on my way to work? I don't know. I think it's there, honestly. It's subtle. It's not really what they were going for. I get that, but
that's commenting on suicide,
but it's all about having a purpose of living. Which someone who wants
to leave you with the joy of living and with a happy he ends the movie thankful for each day, and that's how it that's how it resolves. So I didn't really see much about suicide, but I did see that the message was that life is worth living even if you're just going with the flow and figuring it out and improvising, right?
Maybe this right here must be the definition of great art, that there's so many viewpoints that can be substantiated. There's so many thoughts to ponder, so many different perspectives that are still true given the movie. I mean, in some ways, this is very profound in terms of how Pixar itself has created a film that even launches these kind of conversations. So, Kelly, I never not at all thought of suicide in any way, more like skepticism, or is it nihilism? Is that the right word, Byron? Yeah. Just meh.
Yeah.
Cynicism.
Nothing matters. What, why try? But never went so far in my thinking to think of suicide. But I go back to the point of just how deep this film is and how amazing that this animation film company decide one day, oh, let's write a story about the meaning of life. It's like a joke. I mean, it would be funny if somebody did a comedy about that, but somebody did do this movie, and so very well, in my opinion.
Yeah. I do like the way it ends, Brian said, though, how they offer, they're like, you did so great with 22. And he's like, okay, she's living. And you know what? All right, I guess it's my time to go to the great beyond. And then Jerry shows up and goes, we decided to give you a second chance. And he goes, really? And she goes, wow, what are you going to do with your life? And then the very last line of the movie is, I don't know, but I'm going to enjoy every moment of it. I think I didn't say it quite exactly 100% the way he says it, but he just says, I don't know, but I'm going to enjoy every moment of my life. And that's really the point of the whole movie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Yeah, there are little things to enjoy, and you don't need a purpose. Just got to find the things that make you happy, whether that's eating lollipops at a barbershop or, you know, giving your bagel to the Subway musician.
Purpose is to live.
Yeah. Someone earlier said something about pecan pie. And
Jimmy said,
yeah. The best scene of the movie, in my opinion, is when he's back. He plays the jazz show. He talks to Dorothea. She has that quote about the fish. He goes, that show was great. And he's like, what do we do next? She goes, we do it again tomorrow. And he goes, I thought I'd feel different. He goes home and he sits at the piano. He plays a few notes. And then in his pockets is all the things that 22 picked up that day. And he starts, I love this. He moves his sheet music off the piano and he lays all the things she picked up on the piano. Mm-hmm. And he starts improvising. Like, that's his music.
That's a great, visual.
I love it. It's the best part of the whole movie right there.
I thought the same thing. I love that too.
And to go back to the pecan pie earlier, when he's like her mentor and they go to the hall where that shows his life, and there's a scene of him eating alone, like at a diner, and other little scenes of him like not getting the gigs and stuff. And she goes, your life's so pathetic. But then later when he's playing on the piano with all her stuff, he's remembering all of her moments enjoying life. And then it shifts to his great moments of life. And one of those moments is him at the diner eating a piece of pecan pie. And he has this look on his face like, this is the best pecan pie I've ever had in my entire life. And he's alone. But they show that moment at the beginning of the movie with when he's with 22 mm-hmm. in the great before. And just how like, it's about perspective too. Like, sure, mm-hmm. from the outsider's view, that looks so pathetic. You were eating alone at a diner, right. Like this is your life. But to him, the reason that moment was showed up in the hall was because that was the best piece of pie you ever had. Mm-hmm. I just love it.
No, yeah. I think that's such a great observation. And it's just like the same thing when he's like, oh, that's just living. You know, it's that the way you look and the way you experience. And
I think it's also one of those hindsight things, right? Like you might not in that moment realize that that was a really special moment to be by yourself and have that amazing pie and look out the window. But then months from then, you will remember the way it smelled and the view through that window specifically and realize that was a really great day I had by myself.
And then make you think of your, like I thought of like Abercrombie Fierce.
The smell?
Like on a little pedestal, like when they were in the thing and it had like his scent and stuff, like the nasty body spray.
Oh yeah, like what your museum would be like.
Okay, on a slightly lighter note, as we start to wrap this up, the movie, that's the very ending of the movie. Like we said, the quote he says about living life, but you know, basically the end too is 22 jumping to Earth. And, you know, becoming a person. And I'm surprised Daniel hasn't asked me about the Pixar theory yet. And I'm not going to really talk about it because I don't really have much to say. But does anyone have any? I mean, it's just a theory in the Pixar world. Do you think 22 becomes anyone significant in the Pixar universe?
No, Obama.
You sure you don't want to talk about it?
I think she becomes Mater.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Happy.
That's hysterical.
Happy or lucky. Yeah.
Okay, so here's what I thought on my own. Well, okay, when they show the shot of Earth when she jumps, it's over Asia. And, you know, it doesn't, I don't think it really matters like what part of Earth is showing, but the very next Pixar movie coming out, Turning Red, features an Asian girl. So what if that's 22?
No, because that's in the US though.
Okay, the true. Well, maybe she was born in Asia. We don't know yet. I'm just saying, I was just, but okay. Then I looked online to see what other people said. And a lot of people, because they say in The Great Beyond, and we don't know what time this movie really takes place. And they say in The Great Beyond that time doesn't really exist. So a lot of people think that 22 becomes Riley from Inside Out. And then that would make sense because Pete Doctor also made Inside Out.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go.
I don't know. It was just a fun thing to think about.
I like that way more than a lot of the other dumb
crap. You could go down a lot of. All right.
Yeah,
well, because someone was
Kelly.
Sorry, go ahead.
I think that just kind of shows you're a Pixar nerd. you know so much about it and why all the details that you know. I mean, because she can connect dots that some of us that just watch the movies, you know, would never catch. I meant that affectionately. That you're Pixar nerd. That can, you know, figure out things.
I can be a Pixar nude, though.
No, oh, my
God. Yeah, you can be that, too.
Okay, the truth is...
Your students are listening.
Okay, the truth is, here's the truth. It doesn't matter who 22 becomes, and they don't show us, and it doesn't matter, and it's not about that. And, like, that's a great side of the movie. 22 is ready to go to the Earth. She's ready to become her own person. And we don't know who she's going to be. And it doesn't matter. But it was just fun to think, who does she become? But apparently when the writers, like one of the drafts of the script was going to end the movie of her, like becoming like one of his students, like later and him like noticing that, but they just couldn't get it right. And honestly, to be honest with you,
seems like they added it on or they changed their idea. Like,
yeah,
it seems kind of like just tacked on. Like,
what does
the very
ending? It does end a little abruptly,
though. Go back, and he was like, "Oh, okay, I don't know what I'm gonna do." Credits, like it just seemed like,
you
know,
I thought he was gonna say no.
Me too.
Yeah. So the first time I saw it too, I thought he was gonna go, "No, it's fine. I'm ready to go." But then he ends and he says,
that audiences were like, too sad. I wish he lived.
Yeah.
And they were like, we said earlier,
and Brian said, it's great how he does say, I'm going to live my life. And that's the point of the movie. But then the music teacher in me would have maybe enjoyed him realizing that she became one of his students. I think it's probably better on the a movie perspective side that we don't know who she becomes, but.
I guarantee you there was a test screening and a bunch of children saw it and said, wait, he dies?
Yeah, right?
I don't know, because it doesn't make a lot of sense, because the reason he ends up in the grate before in the first place is because he was like improvising and went into the zone to meet Moonwind, and then like backdoor went into the grate before.
No,
like,
that fell off the... Didn't he jump off? Wait, he's like running away from the light and then he falls off the big ramp?
He's like trying to jump because he like comes into a bunch of souls. So he's like trying to jump like over them. And then he accidentally like falls off the side and like pushes through. Oh, no, he's like up on like a invisible wall that he eventually like falls through. And he's falling for a long time. And then. Yeah, that's the part.
Sorry, that's what you were talking about, Daniel. Sorry.
No, I was talking about the end. You guys were talking about the end, right?
Oh, yeah. I thought you were talking
to find her.
Because he goes back to find 22.
You're right. Yeah. I do think that's a little weird how he's like, he's playing the piano and then he like purposely, I think, is like, oh, I can just go to the zone and go back there.
Yeah. And it's he just hops up.
Yeah.
And he just
why is he heading to the great beyond? Like, that doesn't make sense. Why would he do that? That's actually weird.
Yeah, because Moonwind does it all the time, apparently. Just like shows up in the zone. And just can go and come at his own leisure.
Yeah,
no problem. Yeah, it definitely is a little disjointed.
So, like,
had
he gone into the great light, like, his body would have just been playing piano and then he just, like, slump over and die.
I guess. Yeah.
just like vanished out of there.
Bang! A
bunch of keys. Oh man.
What I was gonna say is I am curious about, and we don't have to have a super long discussion on this, but what do you guys think about this idea that's portrayed in the movie that you're born with like a personality? Obviously it's mostly used as a joke. It's mostly just like, oh, some people are self-absorbed. And at the, actually no, that was a short I was watching. It doesn't matter. Most of them are still, them are silly, but it still is like a choice they made to be like, yeah, before you're born, you're given a personality type. And that's like sort of a strong choice. And I'm just curious if you guys had any strong opinions or just meh, didn't,
Yeah, it is a choice.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, it's like a whole nature versus nurture conversation answered
right
there. If you just, you know, lump people into self-absorbed personalities or whatever. I did think that was a little bit too gimmicky and just like a touch under thought out, I guess, compared to like some of the other. Well, especially just considering how quote unquote deep everything else is, just to have people siloed into a label or an archetype seems, I don't know.
Pre-birth. I mean,
Jimmy, I read somewhere that the director, Peter Doctor, had been thinking for years, his son was like 23 at the time or something that this movie came out, but remembering and reflecting on the fact that as a baby, he had a personality. So, having been a mother, it's true that babies have personality, but really the joy of having children is seeing them develop, you know, because you can't really say a child has a strong, definitive personality at a certain age as babies, but somehow that was important. So I think it was something relevant maybe to the director, but it just didn't get pursued and fully developed. Yeah.
I saw something similar in those little things we were watching on Disney Plus where that him or some of the other animators too felt like their babies and other, like they've had multiple children. Some of them were born. One of the girls they were interviewing specifically from Pixar said, you know, when my child was born, I felt like they had a specific personality and I felt like I knew them already on some level. And I'm sure that's also just a mother having a baby situation, that connection. But that they went that route. They did make that specific choice to say, to become a soul, to get that spark, you're going to have some sort of personality. But I feel like in the movie, they do also kind of say like, And then their job is done. The Jerry's job is done. You're on Earth and then your life's going to happen to you and your personality will continue or change how it's going to change. But you're still born with this much of a personality. You know what I'm trying to say? I felt like they tried to kind of address it a little bit.
And I think all parents would agree, especially parents that have had more than one child, you know, so they're intimately familiar with the babies for all their lives. And there are definitely distinct personalities. So, all right. Want me to do fun facts as they are?
Let's have some fun with facts.
Okay. Well, ever since the very beginning of Pixar, the Pizza Planet truck somehow appears in each film. And in this movie, Soul, it is seen in the Hall of Everything, which becomes actually a venue for quite a few things from other films. The ship in WALL-E, the Axiom, appears in the Hall of Everything. And the Spirit of Adventure, which is like a blimp, appears from Up. And that was another film that this director directed. The whale from the Marine Life Institute of Finding Dory is seen in this movie. There's also a little tiny sign that says A113, which refers to the very earliest days at, California Institute of the Arts? Yeah, their classroom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might wonder, why was Tina Fey's character named 22? And the theory is that Pixar had released 22 movies
before they started this one. Soul is their 23rd film. So that's as good of a reason as any other. Dorothea Williams's name shows up on the cover of a vinyl record in Onward. So a little testament to the previous movie about the upcoming movie. So let's see. The subway station train in this film has the number 2319 on like the side of one of the subway train, the coaches of the train. And that is the same number that was the code in Monsters, Inc. for child contamination. Remember, he comes out with a little 2319. Sock.
2319, yeah.
Yeah. 2319. Right. And also, when they think that he's like, a doctor or something, and he's seen that life, and it shows him this elderly man kind of holding the hand of a child, pointing out to the world. That is exactly a reference to the statue of Walt Disney holding Mickey Mouse's hand in Disneyland. And if you look at them side by side, the image in this movie and the actual, it's called Partners, and Disneyland is just the same. So a little sweet nod to Mr. Disney. So remember in the movie Inside Out when the family has to move to San Francisco because the father was going to work for a startup company, and the startup company was called Brang. And so it must have been successful because in this movie, there's an advertisement for Brang on one of the walls of the subway. Something really interesting. I don't know, Kelly, if it's on the list of things we'll discuss, but Joe Gardner is the first African-American main protagonist of a Pixar movie. Wow. And that was not how it was written in the beginning. It was written for a Caucasian character that was going to be, I think, an actor.
That would have been such a different movie.
Interesting.
Yeah. But they thought that music that
more universal.
That music is much more poignant and universal and so forth.
I think that they stumbled upon the idea of jazz too. And like Brian was talking about, the thematic, you know, verisimilitude of jazz.
And I don't know if this is in your fun facts, Cynthia, but one of the little clips we were watching on Disney Plus, they had similar to like Grace talked about in her fun facts for Coco, how they had a few like Mexican heritage specialists come in for that movie.
Uh-huh.
And this movie, they called it the Cultural Council, maybe. Anyways, they hired same thing, like Black people to come in and like help them with the African-American aspect in New York City. Like the whole relationship of him with his mom and the two ladies that work at his mom's shop. That was, you know, once they were getting to the finalized part of the script, they had these, you know, other Black women working with his mom. You know, kind of like it was in the final script, but like, you know, the ladies on the council were like, he wouldn't call her whatever her name was. I'll just call her Nancy. Like he wouldn't call her Nancy. He'd call her Auntie, you know, like little things like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's in your fun facts, but I thought that was really interesting again, that they brought in, you know, people from that community to be like, are we doing this right? Like, how would you say this? You know, in the barbershop scene, they had a lot of input on what that barbershop scene looked like and stuff. But anyways, I just wanted to throw that in there.
No, it's true. That I definitely
in an interview with Jamie Foxx. Sorry, Jamie Foxx did an interview where he was talking a lot about that barbershop scene. Mm-hmm. And then just like the relationship between the way that they dog on each other and that one random guy and that whole scenario. And then the barber himself being so jovial and, yeah, just how important the barbershop is in a Black community and the sort of networking, if you want to call it that, that happens there. And so like the way that he had to be himself in that space and how, you know, an undeveloped soul is not going to have a very good chance of being a realistic version of him there and how important that is. It's a good interview though.
I know that they brought in professional seamstresses and tailors for the scene where they're tailoring his suit and, well, everything going on in the seamstress shop. I thought that kind of detail, you know, I mean, these animators could have, I don't know, watched videos or just kind of figured out what it takes to use pins to determine where the seam is going to go and how you stand in front of someone and hem something. But they got people to do it, you know, and they modeled after that. Let's see. Joe's story about working to achieve a singular goal and then wondering what to do with the rest of his life once he had that was inspired by Pete Docter going through the similar existential crisis after the massive financial and critical success of Inside Out. It made him, you know, he was just a star after that. And it made him wonder if there was anything left for him to accomplish as a filmmaker. So that's really interesting. He was, you know, answering questions for himself in this film.
I just thought it was really interesting in one of those other extra Disney Plus parts where they say that most people are going to relate to the character of 22 in this movie and not Joe Gardner. Most people don't have a hard, like, singular goal of their life, and they struggle to find that, and they feel less like they're not they're inadequate, and they can't ever reach their potential, and they never find that one thing that's going to do it for them, which is interesting to me because she's not technically the main character. She's, you know, more peripheral, but they knew that she would be the more universal.
Apparently the story was originally more based on her, or 22 was more featured in the original conception of the story.
Disney Pixar loves, like, I feel like a character, an underdog character like that, that kind of like lives in the fringes of the weird universe and is kind of like the one that like shouldn't be doing what they're doing, you know, but is like still making it and like on the verge of, like, you know, whatever problem, like, you know, like extinction or, you know, not being able to get back to Earth in this case or whatever. I just, like, I don't know. It's
yeah. One of the early versions of the script had the entire story told in the alternative universes, not Earth. I don't know how, what they were thinking then, but anyways, so the themes about life and death and rebirth, you know, it had a particular resonance for the co-director on this film. His name is Kemp Powers. In the late 1980s, he accidentally shot and killed his best friend. And that was on the IMDb site. And so I know that he was brought onto the film and he was just so amazing, apparently, so involved with all aspects of the movie. That must have really mattered to him. So also, this is the first time Pixar ever released a movie on Christmas, even though, as Daniel explained, it wasn't ever intended to be a Christmas release date, but it just turns out that it was. I also wanted to mention that I don't remember this, but I saw it in one of the fun facts that Moonwind's passion was Tetris.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Here he is, this metaphysical brilliance crossing all astral planes and everything beyond our understanding. And that was his passion, was Tetris. So it's
that, well, doesn't he say, like,
that's how he gets
I
into
was
the
once
zone.
Yeah.
That's how he gets into the zone.
No, that's how he became a lost soul.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He says, like, oh, yeah, I was once a lost soul myself.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then they, like, just move on, yeah.
Yeah. No, his thing is
flipping
signs or bongos.
Well, that whole notion that your passion can, you can lose yourself in your passion,
totally,
you know, is pretty powerful message.
And also that you can get into the zone flipping a sign.
I love that.
Byron's gonna walk around and be like, oh, that guy's in the zone.
like in real life, you're going to see his own sign guy.
Oh God.
They've lost their touch. I'll tell you, they're just like aggressive on that. They're just handing you shit now.
They're just phoning it in. They got the automated spinner on the thing.
It's right,
like
the robots now
cheating. No, but
one thing. Really quickly, one last thing about New York is that the train depiction is 100% accurate. It does wear you down, and you do turn into a sad, bitter person riding the trains every day. That is completely accurate.
Okay, I have one more fun fact that I feel like is a really important one that she didn't say. This is the first Pixar movie to not have John Ratzenberger do a voice for a character.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah. However, because I don't know if it was because of COVID or they just didn't reach out to him. He didn't do a voice. So instead they animated him as a character without a speaking line in the subway. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you can see him when they're running, when 22 is running away and the cat's chasing him or her. They pass by a guy and he turns around and gives him this weird look. And that's supposed to be John Ratzenberger. I got to say, I finally looked up the clip and I don't really think it looks like John Ratzenberger, but apparently it's supposed to be him. But it kind of looks like him because it's got the semi bald head and the beard. But John Ratzenberger is gray haired. And in this character is not gray haired. I don't know, but whatever. So we'll just say it's John Ratzenberger. Movie
over such a long period of time. How could they not have gotten John in for one day to record one line?
Well, and someone was why couldn't they have had him be that character, turn around when they run by and just go hey, watch where you're going.
Watch it, buddy.
Yeah. just that one line. Anyways. All right. It is time for final thoughts and letter grades. As always, Jimmy, you're going to start us off.
Oh, okay. I've already said it, but my opinion of the movie improved after watching it a second time. There are things about it that rub me the wrong way. You know, I do really love all of the imaginative design that went into it, but the way you guys were talking about the great before, is that what it's called? But anyway, the design of that, you guys are saying that it kind of bothered you in some ways, or at least mom was, and others kind of agreed that you didn't want to spend as much time there as you had to. And I sort of feel the same way. I mean, I think that's mostly part, or at least partly, to do with the fact that the real or Earth is animated just so gorgeously. And I do think there's a intent there on the creator's part that, you know, you're supposed to want to go back to the beauty of Earth and all of the details and the leaves and the everything. You know, that's part of the message of the movie, is to appreciate all of the little things in life. So it does kind of rub me the wrong way when we're in the before place, because it's just not as defined. Literally the edges of all the objects are little particles and undefined. Which again, I love, because I love that idea and the conceptual art idea behind it. But then I'm also kind of it's not necessarily aesthetically pleasing, and it takes up a good chunk of the movie. I mean, it's not grating. It's not dissonant in any way, really. It is pleasing, kind of, but it's just not what I want to be looking at compared to the real Earth that is in the movie. So there's that on an animation level. 22's character bugged me a lot. And I know she's supposed to represent a undesirable outlook. You know, the movie is trying to say that nihilism is something that you could think but ultimately should reject. And so you ought not like her attitude in that regard, at least. But she just... she should have been funnier. And I feel like little 7 to 10-year-olds probably thought she was super hilarious. And maybe even some of you did, I don't know, but her jokes didn't land for me. Even like when she's Joe doing all the things that you described, Byron, laying on the subway grate and enjoying life with the lollipops and all that. It's wonderful to see this man, the character Joe, experiencing all this stuff. But all of the utterances that 22 has don't strike me as likable or particularly delightful in any way. So, and the teacher stuff. So There's little weights on the movie that keep it from ascending to like having a super high opinion of it. But it is dealing with really deep stuff and philosophical things in a really thoughtful way, in a really thought-provoking way. And I think it's really brave of them, but not like Brave, which I liked less. It's better than Brave. Although as I said earlier, I thought they were going to brave me with the cat thing. And that's another little thing I wasn't super fond of. But anyway, I think I end up with all that said, somewhere in the B range. So since I'm undecided, I'm just going to go B, solid B.
All right, Byron.
Well, I think just, you know, as a person in general, music is just such a core part of my life.
And I didn't say that. The music shit's awesome. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, totally. Yeah, I think that the musical scenes alone just put this in like one of like my favorite of Pixar's film offerings, because it's just so, it captures how music makes me feel. And I think listening to what you were talking about earlier, Jim, about him deliberately making the score that way so it could be understood viscerally by human beings. And that alone was just so beautiful and moving. I think that the subject matter, what they're covering is also just, I mean, it's big, it's hard. It's not, there's not really consensus. I mean, how could, none of us have ever died before. So we're not gonna, anyways, I think the subject matter is ambitious, and I think they gave it a real college try. That being said, it's not perfect. So I'm gonna give this movie a mercy A. And I'm going to give it an A because I think that they bit off a really big chunk, and they might not have chewed it all the way up, but they really gave it a whack. And the music, like I said earlier, really elevates it for me. So I give this movie an A just for the ambition alone.
Wow. That's a high grade for you. I'm looking at your other grades and you haven't given that many A's.
I didn't think I was going to like this movie, and I enjoyed watching it way more than I thought I was going to. So it definitely was a sleeper hit for me.
Nice. Cool. All right, Grace.
I really enjoyed watching this movie. It's funny because like when we're talking about it, I find more things that like weren't my favorite, like the cat scenario and just some of 22's parts, you know, like Jimmy's annoyed with her. I can see that. I see why you would be. She's kind of abrasive. But when I think about watching it and how I felt just after watching it, I sincerely enjoyed it. And the music is so good. And the way that they animate the characters and the way that they animate Black characters is not the same. So that's a really perfectly executed thing that they did, and that deserves recognition, just making it a Black character, and the movie has nothing to do with that otherwise, is worth noting too. I think that I want to give it like a solid high B+, just because I don't feel like I need to watch it a bunch again. So I might not give it an A for that reason, but I didn't even question when they're talking about the afterlife, you inherently think people might feel weird about this, but the concepts that they came up with felt so universal and so easy to agree upon that I wasn't questioning them as the movie was going on. Really. My disbelief was suspended enough to just roll with it. And it's a very good movie, I think. So it's a solid B+.
All right, Cynthia.
Guys are making really good cases. I always feel this way. I hate it going first every time you go. I'm like, oh, that's a good point. Sorry, go ahead, Mom.
Okay. I liked the movie, and I just liked it. I wasn't enthralled with it. I wasn't blown away by the, by the story. I felt the conflicts in the story weren't really necessarily very well drawn out. I hated that character, Terry, you know, the guy with the abacus, the calculator guy.
Well, which one was Terry?
Yeah, that guy. I mean, he bothered me. I guess maybe he was somebody that was kind of an enemy in a way, you know, trying to get them back, but it didn't really make my heart pound or anything like, oh no, watch out, nothing like that. I felt that the character of 22, I wanted to know maybe more about that character's arc, and I certainly would have liked to know what became of her later. But the music is outstanding. The animation of Earth, at least, is just stunning. The brilliance of the concept, the attempt to tackle the deepest questions of our heart. You know, what am I doing here? Who am I? What matters? What makes a difference? How can I make a difference in the world? Is just such a admirable quest. So that is high points. I don't know if the movie captured me the way that others of the Pixar filmology has. So I think I'm going to give this movie a B. I don't want to give it a B minus because I appreciate so much of the bravery that it took and the courage to tackle these issues. So just a B.
Okay. Brian.
I thought that this movie has like really, really cool, successful aspects of it. And then like, you know, a couple of things that are a little more flawed. But I really did find that I enjoyed it so much more the second time that I watched it. I think just because I kind of didn't really have to pay attention to like the concept as much, honestly. And I could kind of just notice other little things that make it, you know, I didn't notice before and make it more enjoyable, like life, LOL. I think that the thing that really stands out to me about this movie is how interesting it is that like in this day and age, we have a children's movie like this that is talking about the, you know, the purpose of life and the afterlife and all of that kind of stuff in a totally non like religious / Christian aspect, right? Like what other movies can you think about growing up that talked about the afterlife life for kids and didn't have some kind of like heaven and like angels and that kind of thing? You know, I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just so, it's so interesting. And especially like the fact that it's Disney. So I don't know. I think that that's really cool and very, you know, forward thinking and innovative and stuff of them. So I think for that, and because I really did love like the cool improvisational jazz, I'd give this probably like a B plus, like 88, 89.
All right, Daniel.
Okay. So Brian brought up something really interesting that came up in some of the discourse around this movie when it first came out a year ago, which is like, is this even really a kid's movie? I mean, like how much is there for like kids to hold on? I mean, this is really, Pixar has been maybe heading in this direction with some other movies, but this is like really primarily geared towards adults and adult themes, even if like kids maybe understand it. But I don't know of any young children who've seen it, what they think of the movie. But
I think it just leaves it open. Like I think it leaves it so open to interpretation. Like it'd be easy for someone to say, oh, I can see the Christian aspects of that, and that can tie to my faith. But also it's like, there's no really mention of God. There's no mention of like, you know, I don't know. I just think that it's interesting that they hit the nail on the head with being like artistically vague, successfully there. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, it is ambiguous. And I really liked it. I actually, I'm going to have to go against Jimmy a little bit because my experience, actually, I really, really liked this when I first watched it a year ago, and I was somewhat less impressed on a second watch. was actually my experience. I don't know why that is. It's just like whatever mode you're in on a given day changes the movie. I guess, I don't know. Things are, I'm in a different place and I'm living in a different place than I was a year ago.
That was the case for me, especially my first viewing anyway, that I was just not in a good, you know, mood or whatever the first time.
Right. Well, I think it is. I mean, it's just like the movie is highly conceptual and it's like kind of what I wanted. Cause I mean, this came out, this was a new movie when like I was getting back into watching a lot of movies. And I had gotten a Letterboxd account and all the like film nerds on Letterboxd love this movie. And so like that community was into it. I don't know what the broader appeal is, but it's just like, cause I mean, it's so aesthetically and visually studied and all this, and it's very high concept. And I like all that stuff. I noticed more of the problems with it, I guess, this time. That there's like some illogical stuff in the movie that doesn't make a lot of sense. But the character design is really cool. The entire score is just like, and I mean, Pixar has no shortage of great scores, but this is just like the music, like in sound experience of the whole movie is just so amazing. I mean, it could get that plus just, you know, like I didn't care as much about character logic stuff because it was all highly conceptual and about discussion of the themes. And I like that. I don't know. I'm like on a B plus A minus borderline. So rewatch it maybe was a little bit harsh and unfair. I'm going to barely edge it out and give it an A minus. Just barely. It's on the borderline, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to start my final thoughts by saying that if I had to grade this, I'm trying to think back to the first time I watched this. If I had to grade this the first time I watched this, I think I would have given it a C. I felt very disjointed. I didn't like the cat twist. Definitely didn't like the portrayal of the music teacher. Didn't really like Joe or 22 as characters. And I just didn't know how I felt about it. And to Jimmy's point, we weren't in a good place when we first, like physically and mentally, when we first watched this movie, probably. But I think I would have had the same reaction regardless of that, to be honest. Rewatching it, ready for all those things, going into it again, wanting to like it more, knowing the things I didn't like about it, definitely enjoyed it more the second time. Always loved the animation style, like I said earlier, of the Jerrys, of the Great Before and Beyond, of just the normal world. Love the animation of the musicians and the score in general. We didn't say this earlier, but I love the way they animated Joe as a character in general, but like, I love that they, you know, make him this like tall, kind of lanky black man, but specifically he's got like the band director gut, you know, like all the band directors, we all got that gut. So I love that. You know, I love this scene, like I said, where he's at the piano and he moves the score and he's playing, you know, using all of 22's little things. And I do love that the overall message is just enjoy life. It doesn't matter what you're doing, who you're with, where you are, like love yourself, love life, find the things to enjoy about it. Great message. I still, you know, and it's the music teacher in me. I still wish that there was more tie into that because he is a music teacher. You know, the first time I watched this, my takeaway was, oh, his purpose was not to be a jazz musician. It was to be, and not necessarily even to be a music teacher. His purpose all along was to be a mentor. But then watching it the second time and then like reading more about it and stuff, that's not the point of the movie. The point of the movie is to enjoy life, which I love. I've always been a proponent of enjoying life my whole life, no matter what you're doing. But it's not my favorite Pixar movie at all. This came out the same year as Onward, and I would rather watch Onward again. It's a little bit easier to take in. Like, we've talked about so many deep things with this movie. So I think that, like, if someone's like, which, let's just put on a Pixar movie. Your two choices are Onward or Soul. Like, I would pick Onward because it's just like more lighthearted and like easier to take in. That being said, I guess Soul is a better movie, like considering all the things we've talked about, like the deep meaning, the score, the animation, like, you know, because on the last one, we did talk about how the Onward animation's like, fine, it's good. You know, it's a different story. But I don't know. I'm trying to grade this. If I were to grade this as how much do I like it? I'd probably give it maybe a B minus, C plus. But like really thinking about it as a movie, how great the animation is, how great the score is, at the end of the day, how good of a message it is. I'm trying to think of this if I was a critic, a true critic. I guess I give it a B. I think I'll give it a B. I'll give it a B. But I think I need to maybe watch this a few more times and like really see how I feel about it. But, you know, it's interesting what Daniel said about that this movie's not really made for kids. And like one of those YouTube channels I watch a lot of Pixar movie things about, they kind of said the similar thing. Like a lot of Pixar movies are made for kids, but parents will also enjoy them. So parents are fine taking their kids to see a Pixar movie. But this is a movie made for adults that children will still enjoy. You know?
It's a good way to put it. And that might be where a lot of the hangups with the cat come in. And some of them are just like, what? Because they are very much a multi-generational audience or playing to one. So they gotta do double duty in that regard.
Yeah. All right, guys. Great discussion. I think we had a lot of good things to say about this one. So again, if you sat through this whole thing and haven't seen Soul, sorry for all the big spoilers, but you know what? Go watch it and tell us what you think. Because we're a little divided on a lot of different topics. So tell us what you think. Is it a good movie? Is it not a good movie? What are your thoughts and opinions? But our homework and our listeners' homework is to watch Luca, which is technically the last Pixar movie on the list, you guys. We almost did it. It's so crazy. But the next Pixar movie, Turning Red, comes out in March. So I think we're going to keep going until Turning Red comes out before we kind of wrap up our quote unquote first season of Friday Flicks. So watch Luca if you haven't. Tune into our next episode and plan on seeing Turning Red in theaters. Not sure if it's on Disney Plus, but that comes out March 11th. Those are our next two movies to watch. Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. And we will see you all next time. Friday Flicks Podcast is a JK Entertainment production. All thoughts and opinions by the participants are theirs and theirs alone. Original theme music by Jimmy Anthony. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Friday Flicks Podcast for updates about future episodes. And please email us at jkentertainment247@gmail.com to contact us and let us know what you think. I'm your host, Kelly Anthony. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.